Hi there, I'm a slightly under the weather Alistair Madden, and you're listening to Season 5, Episode 9 of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. In this episode, we considered the curious case of Lille's Jonathan David. We analysed the goal-scoring exploits of Bologna's Flying Dutchman, and we put Girona's genuine title bid under the Road to Nowhere microscope. We looked at all of those topics and so much more in our usual detailed way. Do check out the show notes for a comprehensive running order of what we discussed and when. This episode is, of course, produced in partnership with Freelance Football Ops. If any of our listeners are freelancing in football, you may be interested in signing up to Freelance Football Ops' subscription-based newsletter. They find jobs which cover writing, design, video, audio, and generally anything in football media every week. For more info, visit freelancefootballops.com or follow at FFOps on Twitter. Right, on now with the podcast. Hopefully you're all staying safe, hopefully you're all staying well. Thanks, as always, for your continued support. Enjoy. Well, Michael Jones is lucky or unlucky enough, shall we say, to be heading along to Old Trafford this evening for Manchester United's Champions League tie with Bayern Munich. But he has been good enough to give us some of his evening to record the podcast. We are looking forward to hearing from him on all things Italian football in due course. But yeah, Michael, before we go on to that, how are you doing? How have you been? And yeah, are you even more in the festive spirit now than you were, say, 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, I think I will after watching Manchester United. Thanks, Ali. I'm not a Manchester United fan myself. I just happen to live quite near Old Trafford at the moment. But yeah, I'm very excited for the game. How about you, Ali?
I'm indifferent in terms of the United game this evening, Michael, but generally I'm good. Busy, but good. Enjoyed my trip down to London. Very productive visit. And yeah, managed to take in some festive sights in the evenings as well. And Kilmarnock, of course, beat Celtic 2-1 on Sunday, which only further boosted my mood. I'd managed to secure tickets for two of Scotland's group stage games at the Euros next summer. So I was already in fine footballing spirits. And then actually in the relatively immediate aftermath of Kilmarnock's win over Celtic, Strasbourg then bagged a 97th minute winner against Le Havre. So you can imagine I was one happy boy on Sunday evening. Now, Rudy Barlow, if you're as happy as I am, then we've got a very happy podcast this evening. How are you doing?
Not quite. I mean, I went to Rayo Vallecano against Celta Vigo on Monday night, and I took some people to the football for the first time in their lives, and my word, Rafa Benitez ruined my evening. Jesus, good Lord, there was just nothing of any juice to come from Celta Vigo. So that was slightly unfortunate. At least the Celta fans and the Rayo fans were quite good, and there was some sort of entertainment for my guests for the evening. But yes, other than that, I'm pretty good. There's been some good football, some very fascinating stuff going on in La Liga. Excited to get onto that.
Beautiful, Barlow. Well, I was going to say, I think I can probably top that in terms of taking somebody along to one of their first football games. I took a friend along to Kilmarnock against Partick Thistle a couple of years ago. Glad to know that we've both taken people along to a footballing experience for the first time and probably ruined the sport for life for those people. But yeah, anyway, enough on negative footballing experiences. Let's focus now on some really exciting developments on the continent. I think, Michael, the best place for us to start would actually be France, and specifically the northeast of France.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Paulo Fonseca's Lille have capitalised on the shortcomings of Rennes, Lyon, and to an extent Marseille to sit quite comfortably in fourth spot. The 2021 champions of France are currently unbeaten in 13 in all competitions. I mean, last tasted defeat all the way back in September against Will Steele's Rams. While there is room for improvement, Fonseca is clearly getting something right at the Stade Pierre Mauroy. Looking ahead with the winter break just around the corner, what should we expect from Les Dogues in the second half of the season? Excuse my pronunciation for any of that as well.
Yeah, Michael, you gave it a right good shot. So yeah, definitely pass marks there for trying, at least. Sounded so condescending there. That was a good attempt. But anyway, focusing on Lille, I have been impressed by them so far this season. And to answer your question, I would absolutely expect them to continue to feature heavily in the race for the European spots after the winter break. Now, taking the customary road to nowhere step back and looking at the wider picture, I think there's an argument to be made that we, or more specifically I, maybe overlooked Lille last season and didn't give them the credit they perhaps deserved. Now, a month or so into that campaign, we spoke at length about Lille's white knuckle Fonseca ball. You may well recall that episode. While we commented on how fun they were to watch, we did also note that, at least in those early days under Paulo Fonseca, they lacked balance and were slightly vulnerable, slightly naive even, defensively. But to their credit, they did then go on to have a fairly positive season, finishing in fifth place and only missing out on a Europa League spot by a single point in the end. And Michael, when you look at the underlying numbers from last season, you do get the impression that they could have finished higher and perhaps even challenged PSG for the title. Adam White wrote a great piece crunching the numbers, crunching the data for Get French Football News. So do go and check that out if you're looking for some further reading. But just to summarise, according to FBref, Lille scored six fewer non-penalty goals than they perhaps should have. And they also ranked second for shots on target, key passes and passes into the final third, while conceding the fewest in all three of those categories in the whole of Ligue 1. And if we look at another source, if we look at Understats data, Lille should have picked up 8 more points than they did, and PSG should actually have picked up 10 fewer points than they did, which in this hypothetical universe anyway would have actually seen Lille win the league. Now, whilst we do need to caveat all of this with the fact that we are talking about the underlying numbers here, and the most important thing is what ultimately happened, how many goals you ultimately score and how many points you ultimately accrue, we can still quite comfortably conclude that Lille were doing a lot of things well last season. And while the underlying figures aren't quite as remarkable this time around, they do still make for relatively encouraging reading. Prior to Fonseca's appointment last summer, we do of course have to remember that Lille had been so inconsistent and generally underwhelming in the 2021-2022 campaign. They of course finished in 10th place. They did very little of note, Champions League round of 16 appearance aside. So with that disappointing campaign in mind, what we have seen over Fonseca's 16 months or so in charge is, yeah, it's quietly impressive progress. We've seen, Michael, how easy it is for some of the traditionally bigger clubs in France to really struggle. We saw it with Saint-Étienne, we're seeing it with Lyon, and we may well have seen it with Lille. But Fonseca has come in, he's picked up the pieces, and he's got the club heading in the right direction again. Now, we couldn't cover Lille in depth without looking at the curious case of Jonathan David. He's 24 next month, and you do have to feel like he's probably not where he hoped he would be, certainly by this stage in his career. So if we go back to August 2020, when he signed for Lille from Ghent in Belgium for just under 30 million euros, there was a feeling that he would maybe spend a season or two in the northeast of France before moving on to the Premier League or elsewhere. And yet, 3 years later, he's still at Lille. Now, while he scored in two of Lille's last three league games, he has generally struggled in front of goal this campaign. He missed an absolute sitter, actually, in the recent win against Metz. If you've not seen it, do go and check that out. Perhaps the biggest miss of the season so far, and may well, come the end of the season, still be the biggest miss of the season. But that sort of summed up how things have been going for him over the last few months. That said, Michael, we do know that he is a proven goal scorer, 64 goals in 156 games in all competitions since signing for Lille as a healthy return. And last season was actually his most prolific yet in the league, scoring 24 times. Admittedly, do have to note that quite a few of those goals were penalties, but it's still a very healthy return. I don't want to cast too many aspersions on where his head is maybe at these days, but you do wonder if he is perhaps just slightly down, maybe slightly demotivated even, because a bigger move hasn't yet materialised. Interestingly enough, Milan are said to be weighing up a January move for him, and that does seem like a sensible next step for him as he looks to progress his career. Lille have been good for him and he's been good for Lille, but it does feel like the time has maybe come for club and player to part ways. I do just want to spotlight a couple of other young players at Lille, younger players even than Jonathan David, who have really impressed me. So in goals, you've got the 22-year-old Luca Chevalier, and in the centre of defence, you've got the 18-year-old Lenny Yoro, both of whom are graduates of the same youth academy at Lille that has produced the likes of Eden Hazard, Benjamin Pavard, Luca Digne, Kevin Morales, and Johan Cabaye. So looking firstly at Lenny Yoro, he only turned 18 last month, but he's already showing signs that he can go on to become a world-class defender. So he made his Lille debut back in May 2022 against Nice when he was just 16, and he has gone, Michael, from strength to strength since then. So this season he's started the last 13 league games, forming part of a defence that has kept a remarkable 8 clean sheets over that period, and he's also picked up a few caps with the France under 21 side, who are of course managed by Thierry Henry these days. Now, in terms of how he plays, he's tall, which naturally has its benefits, but he's also great with the ball at his feet. So a real feature of his game actually is his ability to advance out of defence with the ball at his feet to resist pressure. And when we couple that with his diverse range of passing, we start to see why so many big teams are interested in him. He's also got a good turn of pace. He reads the game well. And yeah, he's got a goal in his locker too, as we've seen this season. He's got 2 goals already, which is a decent enough return for a central defender. In terms of his underlying numbers, those aren't hugely impressive, but when you watch him play and when you think about the extent to which he's already refined his game, his skill set, you do feel like Lenny Yoro has the potential to go on and become one of France's next great centre-backs. Looking now at Luca Chevalier, he's started every league game for Lille this season, and I think it is fairly rare for a keeper so relatively young, in Chevalier's case, 22. It is rare for a goalkeeper that young to be starting so regularly. And so I think for Paulo Fonseca to have such faith in him, yeah, that does tell us a lot about Chevalier's ability, his character even. He's a local kid. He was born in nearby Cali, and he does already feel slightly box office. He is, yeah, he's one of Lille's own. He saved 2 penalties in 1 game against Metz at the start of December, which was the type of feat that was always going to create headlines. And he was also an integral part of the France under 21 squad at the under 21 Euros in the summer, where he started all 4 of France's games. Now, he is still quite raw, as you perhaps would expect from a 22-year-old goalkeeper. There are, of course, still mistakes in his game, and those mistakes are probably most obvious in a goalkeeper's game. And it does, at times, feel like he's not quite confident enough yet to step away from his near post and give himself a better starting position. That said, he's an increasingly great shot stopper, and his distribution is a real asset for his team. His distribution really enables Lille to play the way they want to play. He also sits in the 88th percentile for post-shot expected goals minus goals allowed, and in the 93rd percentile for clean sheets when compared with goalkeepers across Europe's top 5 leagues. Now, good old Rémi Cabella, you probably remember him from his time at Newcastle, for example. He now plays with Lille, and he has been singing Chevalier's praises. So he said, quote, "If we are here now, it is also because we have a great goalkeeper and we must congratulate him. He can reach a very, very high level, and why not the French national team? I think he deserves it and it will come," unquote. So just to echo Cabella's comments, it does feel like Chevalier is destined to become the national team's number one at some point in the future. Just on that point as well, the French goalkeeping landscape does look rather interesting right now. You've obviously had Hugo Lloris and Steve Mandanda, who've retired from international football fairly recently. You then got Alphonse Areola, Brice Samba, and Mike Maignan, who are in that sort of 28 to 30 age bracket, either about to hit their peak or have hit their peak. And then there's this emerging crop of younger goalkeepers that includes the likes of Ilan Meslier, Albin Lafont, and of course, Luca Chevalier. So yeah, let's see how Chevalier continues to develop over the next few years. And yeah, let's see if he can ultimately make that number one jersey his own with the national team. Do go and check out the Athletic's article dissecting his game if you're in the mood for some further reading. Looking now at Lille's upcoming fixtures, their home game against PSG 8 days before Christmas will provide them with the perfect opportunity, you would imagine, to get revenge for the humiliating 7-1 loss they suffered in the same fixture last season. So if they can pick up a point or three from that one, and if they can win away to a struggling Strasbourg side in their final game before the winter break, they'll set themselves up very nicely indeed for the second half of the campaign. And yeah, they'll absolutely be thinking they can go on and secure a spot in next season's Champions League group stages. On a closing note, Michael, you may well have seen the heartwarming footage of the Lille fans throwing more than 5,000 stuffed toys onto the pitch at the Stade Pierre-Mauroy at half-time in the recent win over Metz, all in aid of underprivileged kids at Christmas. So if you've not seen that clip, do go and check it out. I promise it will warm the cockles of your heart. I know, Barlow, that the Real Betis fans do something similar at the Estadio Benito Villamarín, and a lot of ice hockey teams as well do it in America. And I think it's a really great gesture. I would love to see something like this catch on in Scotland in and around Christmas. Without getting too deep, there are a lot of bleak and brutal headlines around the world, and so it is nice to be reminded every so often that there are reasons to be cheerful and that there are good people out there. So on that rather uplifting note, I think we'll draw this section of the podcast to a close. We're going to take a very brief break now before coming back to look at the latest developments in Italy. We'll be right back.
In Italy, Atalanta's 3-0 away defeat to Torino at the beginning of December meant they had gone over a month without a league win and registered just 2 league victories since the tail end of September. The club from Bergamo did, however, put an end to their winless woes in magnificent fashion against Milan on match day 15, with Luis Muriel's audacious flick in the 95th minute securing all 3 points for Gianpiero Gasperini's side. So, Michael, what changed for Atalanta in this enthralling Lombardy derby?
It was a much braver performance. And I think, you know, people get saturated with the likes of character and intensity when analysing football. But, you know, there's a reason that that's said sometimes. And I think in terms of just basic sort of a well-functioning team, that was certainly one of the factors that helped. I think they really took the game to AC Milan right from the start. Shaw de Catalara, who I'll come on to in a sec, he missed an absolute sitter in the first few minutes before a double from Adamola Luckman put them in front twice. AC Milan responded both times through Olivier Giroud, then Luka Jovic, before this fantastic winner when Atalanta really pushed at the death. And yeah, it was one of those goals where I think it's safe to say some of the best goals we do see in football are often the result of a bad first touch. And Luis Muriel's sort of running onto this ball that's been cut back to him, and his first touch just leaves it, even though he's very close to the goal and Maignan's rushing towards him, his touch just means it goes slightly behind him. If it was intentional, I hold my hands up and apologise to Muriel straight away, but I'm not sure it was. But it did just, it looked like it might even take the chance away from him, or at least force it him to take a shot on his left foot, where he didn't have a fantastic angle and Maignan had his angle as well, but instead he's kind of Cruyff flicked it through the sort of between the arm and body of Mike Maignan into the corner. And it is, yeah, an absolutely glorious goal and a glorious way for Atalanta to refine that form. And yeah, they just generally struggled recently. I think one of the things Gianpiero Gasperini has, we've seen him sort of go through many different phases during his time at Atalanta. When we started on the podcast a few years ago, everything was super rosy, and I think it's safe to say in the past 2 or 3 years that's not been the same. And we saw towards the back end of the 2022 season him becoming increasingly disgruntled with what was that current crop of Atalanta, and in the past 18 months or so he's really tried to rebuild this team, and it's almost like he's found a newfound patience. And whether that team are going to make a similar journey to what his previous era or generally previous era of players did is yet to be seen. But there's so much cause for optimism within the ranks, you know, just looking at players. Adamola Luckman, still in his mid-20s, he has been a real shining light for them this season. Edison, a player we spoke about a few times, he arrived from Salernitana in that summer of 2022. And he was just voted their player of the month for November, despite them not being able to get the wins. And for players like Charles de Ketelaere, who I was listening to him on a podcast the other day, and they said that he could risk becoming the worst pound for pound signing in Serie A recent history, at the very least, given how much he cost AC Milan when he joined in 2022. But he joined on loan with an option for Atalanta to buy this season. And despite scoring on his debut versus Sassuolo, hadn't really seen those signs of what made him such a standout talent at Club Brugge in Belgium. Yet, despite what we saw, and we talk about this bravery and his character and resilience, despite him suffering that awful, horrendous miss, which was a near post, he looked short to score, he wasn't under too much pressure, had the time to just lift it into the top of the net, and he's ended up leaning back too far, skying it. Instead, what we've seen him do is provide an absolutely glorious assist for Ademola Lookman for Atalanta's second goal, which gives them the lead, and he played an instrumental role throughout the match. And despite him having an indifferent campaign so far, I think Gasperini will really be looking for a big response to this win, rather than, you know, we saw the response against Torino last week when they lost 3-0, like you said. But it'll be, I almost think this response will be more important, and whether they can put a run of games together. It's important to stress as well, Atalanta by the end of September had actually made a really bright start to the season and were near the top of Serie A. And since then, they've gradually dropped out of the top four. But given the sort of respective failures and struggles and shortcomings of teams around them, they've been able to benefit from that a little bit and still very much find themselves in the top four race. And I think the game itself exposed more problems with AC Milan than it did with Atalanta. But even in that sense, this was a game, by the way it went, that Atalanta should have won. You know, they dominated the match and they should have won more handsomely and more comfortably. But some of their, I think, defensive problems, one in particular, if you look at three of the last four goals they've conceded, or four of the last five even, if you look at the Torino match and the AC Milan match, four of those have come through crosses, three of them sort of directly through crosses, one of them a corner, two in open play. And then one that also came from a corner led to a penalty, which was a handball. And that inability for them to deal with crosses, teams are really beginning to exploit that. Torino had so much joy out of it. Duvan Zapata came back to haunt his old club by scoring a double in that win in midweek. And AC Milan scored almost an identical goal to Zapata's first goal when Luka Jovic equalised. And it's this kind of cutback cross, which rolls so slowly along the ground. But I think the fear and lack of confidence in the Atalanta defenders means when they are defending crosses, they tend to sit right in front of the goal, rather than to try and attack crosses in a defensive manner, that it just gives players that sort of free run on to generate the power or the finish and the time in order to put that shot away, which Luka Jovic, you know, the Serbian striker, devoid of confidence, was able to do. And I think that kind of leads into some of the other problems that you may get with this Atalanta side, which I don't think are all necessarily doom and gloom, because I think what we find ourselves with their sort of recruitment strategy, not just with this current crop of players, but what they've maybe suffered from a little bit in the past as well, is that their transfer strategy and Gasperini's strategy has been to have players who can sort of fit in many different positions, almost like a jack of all trades, master of none. And I think they've struggled to have any players at any part of the pitch that have really, really excelled in either position. You could look at Ademola Lookman and whether, you know, at what side of the attack does he play. You could look at Giorgio Scalvini, one of the brightest prospects in terms of his sort of ability on the ball and reading of the games at times. You know, he's been deployed sometimes as a defensive midfielder, which I think he's maybe showing signs of becoming more suited to, or a centre-back where, you know, despite his tender age, he is still making rash decisions in that sense. And he was one responsible for conceding that penalty versus Torino in the midweek as well. But I think you can look at other areas of the pitch as well. Luis Muriel hasn't always been utilised centrally. And I think as a result of this, there's been constant rotation. They've kind of got a lot of players at a similar stage of the career where you feel like they're just a good run of form away from really breaking through and being standout stars in the league. But I think this kind of balancing act that Gasperini's had to do at times, whether that be Scamacca, who's looked a bit better for me in the Europa League than he has in Serie A. And I think them trying to juggle European football, where they've had, you know, it should be said, despite the league struggles, they've had an impressive Europa League campaign so far, and it looks like they should qualify top of the group there. But I think, yeah, he's got this kind of balancing act to do. And I would just say, Gasperini, he does seem to have more patience with this crop of players as well. He's talked about the need for, with the Catalara, for example, you know, he put a big emphasis on not focusing on the miss post-match, but on the assist and his all-round overall play, saying that that form will come. And I think if you look at some of the conversations he's had with players in recent years, whether that be Hans Hattabur or somebody else, he's maybe not shown that similar level of patience. So if they are to start finding a bit more of a winning formula, whether that be positionally, formationally, and just in terms of how they attack games, whether they look for this kind of control or whether they do look to be much more direct, yet still playing it along the floor, I think there's just some big questions that they have to figure out. And I think to what extent they figure that out will define their success and define Gasperini's kind of second part of his stint in Bergamo. But yeah, it was an absolutely fantastic win. And I think there were signs, you know, there were signs and causes for optimism with this team that we've really not been seeing enough of in the last few weeks. And Luis Muriel is a player whose, I think, career, it's safe to say, has been defined by hot and cold streaks. If you ever needed a goal to kind of lift you and bring that kind of run of goal scoring form back, I think that's it, exactly the kind of goal that would have done it despite his first touch.
Yeah, interesting stuff. And if we look just above Atalanta in the Serie A table, we find Bologna, who have arguably been the success story of the season so far in Italy. Those who followed our analysis of head coach Thiago Motta and Lewis Ferguson's emergence won't be totally surprised by this, but there is another young talent breaking through the ranks at the Renato Dell'Ara. Tell us all about Joshua Siukse and the impact that he's had in Emilia-Romagna so far, Michael.
Yeah, Siukse is a player that I'm not sure a few years ago I thought I'd be talking about too much when I first saw him grace Italian football with Parma in, I think it was 2021. He was there on loan in their relegation season. But yeah, he's had a huge impact for them, particularly at the weekend where he enabled them to get their first away league win of the season, which is hard to believe given this is a team that have only lost twice all season and find themselves joint fourth. They are in fifth, but for the sake of this argument, they're in joint fourth with Roma on 25 points and only 4 points adrift of AC Milan in third. And yeah, he was crucial to that victory. His first goal was just a simple rebound, but his second goal was really nicely taken. It was, again, him making a run, which he has been doing off the kind of left-centre channel and just taking it around the Salernitana goalkeeper, Castillo, and placing it into the goal. And Bologna actually should have won by more. You mentioned Lewis Ferguson there. Lewis Ferguson's had a fantastic season, and I think him and Siukse have been playing really well off one another. But Ferguson also had a golden opportunity to make it 3-0 for Bologna and make it a much more comfortable affair before they did let Salernitana back into it by conceding the goal midway through the second half. And what should have been a comfortable game to see out, I think those away day jitters were certainly there. So I think one of the things we are going to very briefly focus on, something Bologna have to work on, which they are showing signs of progress with, is that confidence to play the way Thiago Motta wants Bologna to play away from home. But Siukse's really emerging as a player. I think people who have, despite him maybe not having the numbers to make him a really prolific standout player, I think his career trajectory makes him a player that's very familiar to some. I think he scored 4 goals in 9 games when he broke through Bayern Munich during the COVID 2019 season in 2020. He then sort of struggled, I think, both with on and off field issues to live up to that early hype that he'd set when he was just a teenager at that point. And the successive loan spell to Parma didn't really help build on that. And I think we spoke about this actually on the podcast a couple of, over 2 years ago, actually, at the time. And I think that was also symptomatic of a Parma team that had essentially tried to bring in a huge influx of young, very young players and get them playing fluidly together, which, as we normally know, doesn't tend to work out so well. But I think where that did work out a bit better for Zirkzee was when he went on loan to Anderlecht. And again, another kind of high profile moment of his career so far is when there was this video of when Vincent Kompany was doing a halftime team talk or a full-time team. I think it was a halftime team talk during his time at Anderlecht the season before he took the Burnley job. And he called out Zirkzee for basically being a prima donna. And I think anybody who kind of seen that clip and had sort of seen Zirkzee's career at that point may have easily made the wrong assumption that he's not the hardest working player, that he has a lot of attitude problems, and that he wasn't a player that was really going to make the kick on anytime soon. But he's defied all those kind of, I'd say, kind of lazy criticisms of him so far this season. I mean, even in Anderlecht, it should be said he scored 16 goals during that season. So it wasn't like he was a player struggling, but I think the expectancy may have been that he was playing at a higher level already at that point. But yeah, despite being a bit part player last season, I remember seeing him in Motta's first game when I was at Bologna last season, and he came on as a substitute and ended up being quite an ineffective number nine. At the moment, at that time, Bologna were rooted towards the bottom of the Serie A table. It just shows how far both him and the team have come during that time. I think he's on 7 league goals for the season now, but he's also showed a pretty creative side. He's got 4 goals and 1 assist in the past 4 games. And it's a sign of a player who I think is starting to find both his position, his role within the team, and is utilising his skill sets. At 6'4", he's not the quickest player, but and he's not necessarily always the strongest player, but I think he's becoming increasingly aware of how to use his body more effectively. He's up there with one of the highest percentiles for players compared to his position in terms of take-ons, and we saw that perfectly at skill when he took the ball past Castile and scored the winner versus Salernitana the other day. And yeah, he tends to find himself enjoying to drift off that left-hand side. And I think previously there was a good scouted report on him, and they said that when he was in Anderlecht, I must admit, I didn't really watch him there much at all, but I remember seeing him at Parma and could definitely agree with this analysis that one of the things he was guilty of was just, being really rash with his finishing. He's a very two-footed player, but that he would tend to just try and get a shot away on goal rather than thinking about where he's going to place it, whereas his passing has always kind of had that more calculated precision to it. And we're starting to see that a lot more, I think, so far this season. So, 7 goals from 15 league games being played into the season, you'd certainly expect him to hit double figures. I think he's had this blossoming relationship with Lewis Ferguson. I think from what it says about his character as well, he had a really good relationship with other key figures in the game, Marko Arnautović, who's kind of succeeded as that talisman up front for Bologna this season. Arnautović now back at AC Inter Milan. Arnautović said that he believed in Zirkzee to take over this role, and I think that kind of indicates his prowess, maybe on the training field that wasn't necessarily translating into matches. And speaking of his relationship with Vincent Kompany, despite that video that went round, I think that's largely been a very fruitful, positive relationship. And I think Zirkzee's career has generally been very good since then. So, yeah, I think we're just starting to see it's just the beginning for Zirkzee, if he wants it to be. I think it'd be very disappointing if there was going to be a second fall off after, maybe the false start he had a few years ago. And you do wonder with some players, if they do have a second false start, how many more they can have. But going by what he speaks very well, and I don't think he's that far away from a Netherlands national team call-up for the full squad. He's yet to make his debut. And with the Euros on the horizon, I'm really hoping that he can push on comfortably hit double figures for goals and hopefully, you know, at least double his tally in the league for the season and really make that push for the Euros this summer. Because I think even though it's way too early for him to be a major player for them, I think he should be, with the talent that he has and the talent that he possesses, especially technically, the ceiling should be, and his own ambitions should be, pretty high.
Yeah, Sabitzer, an interesting one. One of those players who, yeah, as you could say, has that kind of raw talent, but you're never quite sure when or if they'll deliver on it. I always think that sometimes we're a bit too harsh on players who are 20, 21, 22, and generally we say players peak at 26, 27, but we're generally quite reluctant to wait until they do. And yeah, Thiago Motta, rumoured outside shout for the Barcelona job if things go pear-shaped for Xavi at some point. Early on Monday evening, we saw Empoli, who hosted Lecce. Since their respective returns to Italian football's top flight over the past three seasons, the two teams have had overperformed, largely due to their sustainability and nurturing of young talent. However, this fixture arrived at a moment when both teams were desperately in need of a win. How did this tie play out, Michael, and what should we make of these two teams this season?
Surprisingly, it played out in a 1-1 draw, Barlow. Mm-hmm. And looking at the two teams so far, that shouldn't come as a major surprise either. And yeah, like you said, two teams desperately in need for a win as well. Lecce have drawn four games in a row, albeit, you know, two of those have been against Milan and Bologna, two teams who are at their better end of the table than them. As for Empoli, they've drawn their last two games now as well, but out of their last four, they beat Napoli 1-0, albeit it was moments away from being a draw. It's a last minute winner there, which cost Rudy Garcia's job. And then they lost 4-3 again with late drama to Sassuolo, their nearby neighbours. And both teams aren't in the best positions. It could be a worse scenario for them both in the league this season. Lecce are sitting 13th on 17 points and Empoli are 18th on 12, which does sound alarming. But I think if we start with Empoli in this case, if you consider where they were at the start of the season and the summer they'd just gone through, it was looking rather perilous for them. But I think the one sort of ray of hope that you had with them was the manner in which they were run. They're running in a relatively calm manner as well, and they don't tend to make rash decisions. But you know, they lost their first five league matches of the season, didn't score a goal until a 1-0 win over Salernitana, who are in an equally kind of perilous situation. But it should be said, Empoli absolutely dominated that game as well and probably should have won by more, which kind of belies their struggles in front of goal. But yeah, since then, they've picked up two wins in the last 2 months over Fiorentina local rivals and that Napoli one, which we just mentioned. And I think kind of both for Empoli and Lecce, I think they've both been in this difficult situation for maybe in terms of recruiting really good players and attracting really good players, in the sense that despite being Serie A regulars or thereabouts over the past two decades or so, I don't think either team has really had that appreciation from outside of Italy. And you know, I think for various reasons, I don't think either team's really achieved so much that's been absolutely outstanding. If you maybe compare them to Sassuolo or somebody similar, or even Atalanta, you know, in the past 20 years or so, I had that period, even what Palermo had in the mid-noughties or something. And I think Empoli, in particular in Empoli's case, they're surrounded by Bologna, Sassuolo and Fiorentina. So I think they've always found, in terms of attracting high-profile players, quite difficult. But you almost felt like they were in need of that a little bit more, in the sense that the way the summer went, they lost Vicario, who's been one of the best, I think the best goalkeeper hands down in the Premier League this season, and replaced him with the Albanian goalkeeper, Etrik Berisha, who made an absolute clanger in the game versus Lecce, where he conceded a long range strike. And they were very fortunate to get back into the game, actually. It's Nicolo Cambiaghi's cross that deflected into the goal from a ridiculous angle, and I don't think Lecce could really do much out from it. And I think Lecce probably definitely deserved the win in this game. And it wasn't just Vicario that they lost in the summer. They also lost Fabiana Parisi, Aslani permanently, although that had already been he'd already spent time at Inter Milan prior And I think one of the issues that they've had is just having the trust to bed in players to replace them, but also finding goal scoring formulas. Other than Francesco Caputo, who's got 3 goals, 2 of them were late on. All their other players have only scored 1 goal. We've talked a lot about Tommaso Baldanzi, a player that's really caught the attention of many people in Italy and beyond, partly for his under-20 performances at the World Cup over the summer, but also because of his performances for Empoli last season. He's struggled a bit for fitness and consistency so far this season and has only got that 1 goal yet to record an assist so far. And I think when you look at the lowest goal scorers, lowest expected goals in Serie A also, and it's just been quite a difficult period for them. Daniel Maldini, one of the players brought in, Simone Bastoni, Alberto Grassi as well. Really good, you know, talented players. Grassi's been there a bit longer, but they've just maybe not had the confidence to succeed. And I think slowly but surely, we are seeing a slight improvement from Empoli. They've got 5 points out of the last 12, which isn't a bad return for them compared to points per game otherwise so far this season. And then I think when you get to Lecce, they've obviously, their season's almost been the opposite. They've started really, really well. They were undefeated up until match day 6 when they faced Juventus and Napoli and lost back to back, and then again went 2 games undefeated and then lost 3 in a row. And then again, they've been undefeated since, albeit it's been 4 draws, but that's culminated in this 11 game run where they've not actually had any wins. And these two teams, I think, because of that inability to attract the high profile type of players, or at least at the right end of their careers, they have had to rely more on, you know, signing exciting young talents and developing them, or, you know, having a good scouting model. Primavera winners were Empoli only not too long ago. And then I think if you look at some of Lecce's players, we talked about the impact that some of them had had last season, but I think this time around, you look at Lamet Banda, a Zambian winger who scored a goal at the weekend. He's got 2 goals, 3 assists this season. He's been real bright spot for them. And Nikola Krstovic, who has scored 4 goals. He's a top scorer, a 23-year-old Montenegrin striker also. And I think both of them have maybe struggled a bit in terms of replacing the high-profile departures they had defensively. I think Samuel Umtiti kind of joined Lecce to rebuild his career. He finds himself in France now. I think replacing him has been difficult. And I think for Empoli, like replacing Parisian Vicario has been difficult. But I think given the way that these two clubs have run, given their scouting models, given their sort of savviness in the transfer market, I don't think these are two teams that are going to be at the wrong side of the table come next spring / early summer.
Now, in Spain, Barcelona had their chances against Girona, but the general feeling is that the supposed little brother wiped the floor with Catalonia's principal side on Sunday night. Girona, of course, won 4-2 away at Barcelona, a result that allowed them to take a 2-point lead over Real Madrid at the top of the table. Now, we've put Girona under the Road to Nowhere microscope on several occasions in recent seasons, and given we are now 16 games into their 2023-2024 miracle, it does feel like an appropriate moment to cover them once again. So, Barlow, what's changed, firstly, to make Girona such a difficult and challenging outfit for any side, and a problem for every team? And secondly, I guess the ultimate question is, without wanting to get too far ahead of ourselves, can they actually go on and do it and win the league?
I'm not letting myself get my hopes up, because I think it would be, I mean, Leicester City obviously is the comparison that's not only been thrown around in Spain, but everywhere else. And I'm not letting myself get my hopes up, because I think it would be arguably even more of an achievement if Girona were to do it. I mean, this is a team that has a salary limit, and we know that they have links to the City Group. Everybody points that out every 5 minutes. But I mean, this is a team that has a salary limit of 52 million, I think it is. For context, that's an eighth of what Barcelona have to spend. It is what, about 10th, 11th, 12th of what Real Madrid are spending right now in their squad. So this isn't kind of a team that's been bankrolled by the City Group. It's a team that does have connections, it does have links. Jan Couto is a useful player, as is Savio, who we'll kind of get onto. But this is the team that I since probably Pep Guardiola's Barcelona, Tito Villanova's Barcelona, I'd say it's the team that's closest to playing kind of Cruyffian football, the team that rotates their positions most, that's most kind of free-flowing. They're so fluid, they're so flexible. Other teams can't really get a handle on them. And even though other sides have obviously thrown up more difficulties than Barcelona did on this occasion on Sunday night, beaten 4-2, and it was really quite sort of stark, the contrast in the two sides and how comfortable Girona were in the way that Girona found solutions to play against this Barcelona side. There's two possessions. It's about 2-1 in the second half. Barcelona had been kind of pushing, creating a few chances at this point, and it looks like they might get back into the game. And around the 70th minute, there's two possessions. One of them is, I think it must be about over 2 minutes long. There's another one that's about a minute and a half long just after. And just the level and the presence of mind for a team to be able to do that, to keep the ball for that long, to take the sting out of Barcelona, to kind of shift the balance of the game, the equilibrium and the momentum back into their favour. It's really high, high level stuff. It's the sort of thing that you expect from Pep Guardiola's Manchester City, or kind of Luka Modric taking over a game for Real Madrid. It is up there with that kind of level. You look at two of the key members of that Girona victory over Barcelona, and one of the things that's been most stark about teams at the top of the game in recent years is kind of getting the most out of their fullbacks. Joao Cancelo being perhaps the prime example on the other side for Barcelona, his development at Manchester City, the way that Philipp Lahm was used for Bayern Munich, and Miguel Gutierrez and Jan Couto were a large part of the reason that Girona were able to win this game. Jan Couto, who wasn't even a starter last season, isn't necessarily always a starter this season, but takes the ball, goes past the player, and then plays a pass that takes about 5-6 Barcelona players out of the game for the first Girona goal, beats the entire press, and Joao Felix was a little bit lazy on it, but the quality that he showed there was impressive. The kind of presence of mind, the calmness, the way that he was able to dissect the situation like that for a side that, again, let's stress this, were promoted two seasons ago and not in kind of, they didn't run away with the second division. They finished sixth and they got through the playoffs. This was not a side that was necessarily expected to pull up trees last season. Jan Couto did that and that was very impressive. Miguel Gutierrez scored a goal but had two or three opportunities where he would just crash inside the box. I mean, they had Savio who was out wide on the left occupying Koundé, and Miguel Gutierrez's run is just something they couldn't stop. And part of that is slackness from Barcelona, but part of that is the fact that Gutierrez has become one of the key kind of attributes of this Girona side, a player that's comfortable going outside but comes inside far more often, a fullback that looks like a fairly kind of standardized quality left back, it has to be said, but somebody who's good on the ball, good going forward, get to the byline at Real Madrid. And he's come to Girona and he's essentially become an auxiliary kind of central midfielder for Girona, someone that allows Savinho that space outside, but somebody that gives them superiority in the middle, somebody that's comfortable taking the ball under pressure with his back to goal in his own half as well, which is not easy for a fullback when, I mean, speaking particularly, I mean, it's not a comparison, but myself, as somebody who grew up as a fullback, you always have the game in front of you. And that's kind of the advantage if you're not too technically gifted, as is the case for me. And you're never kind of under pressure receiving the ball, or certainly not back in my day. But the two of them are marks or kind of evidence of Michel's work, of his ability to make sure the side is operating at a high level. Daley Blint, I mean, veteran player who we've all kind of seen at some point in our football watching careers and seen him pop up in various places and be good to a degree, but always, again, kind of look like he's not necessarily cut out for that top level, but he's performing at a top level right now. Eric Garcia, another who's written off by a lot of players, and really, I have my doubts about him still, but he managed to kind of cut it against Barcelona here. He was really, really solid against Joao Felix in this game and highly impressive. And one of the things that Michel has emphasized, and let's not forget they did this without Yangel Herrera, who's supposed to be kind of their hard man in midfield, the guy who wins the duels, the guy who battles, who's physical, who's big, who can get up and down. They went to Barcelona without him. Instead, they were playing David Lopez, who's been at centre back for most of the time this season, playing him in midfield. And it's just so impressive. And the way that they looked so comfortable against the Barcelona side, that looked so ragged at times, so disjointed. I think it's an iconic game and it's iconic win, even though Barcelona did have their chances. We'll come on to that in a wee moment. But yeah, the one of the things that Michel has emphasized in kind of interviews of late, he was saying that he was a footballer, he played for Rayo Vallecano back in the day, and he was saying that having the footballers be comfortable and not asking them to do things that they aren't comfortable doing is one of the keys to him, because he was saying that when you press high, you're uncomfortable as a player because you know you could get beaten. I mean, it's a simple pass around the corner. It's the sort of thing that could undo the entire team, is if you press at the wrong time, is if you go at the wrong time, you're the one that looks like an idiot, as happened to Joao Felix against Girona. And so it's really interesting to see how Michel manages to do that. I mean, at times they're not always pressing high. They do drop deep at times, but they press in kind of fits and starts. And it's just all of these players who had been good or talented players in the past, the majority of them have had futures or potential, but never really made good on it. Alex Garcia being perhaps the prime example that we touched on a few weeks ago. Just how happy they were to take on this pressure against Barcelona away from home, a side that, yeah, it's never, I don't think they've ever beaten them away from home. And it's just, yeah, it's so, so impressive. So my hat's off to Michel. And can they do it? Yeah, again, I'm still reluctant, but you look at the way that they played this game, they've got Atleti coming up just after the winter break. They took Barcelona to the cleaners, obviously, in some senses, put four goals past them. And against Real Madrid, those first kind of 15 minutes, they should have scored two or three goals in that game too. And had Real Madrid not gone in front, I mean, ifs, buts and maybes, you never know how that game would have played out. So on a week-to-week basis, it's really hard to see how some of these teams stop Girona, because they're just playing such good football and they're so confident. And it's a testament not only to having a system or a team that's comfortable, organised, confident, believes in their own ability, but yeah, having a side that doesn't kind of fear the opposition in the same way that so many managers approach this game. And yeah, it's a work of art. We're only 16 games in, but right now 12-point gap to fifth place, it's hard to, they will drop off to an extent, I think. I think they've got a real, real shot of making the Champions League here.
Yeah, Barlow, well, based on what I've just heard you say, I'm going to say that it's a genuine title bid. I'm going to be more optimistic. I'm going to, yeah, exercise less caution and say that we have a genuine title bid on our hands here from Girona. But of course, that could all be, yeah, excessive optimism on my part. Now, looking at Xavi and Barcelona now, the side, of course, that suffered that heavy in the end defeat against Girona. You promised us that you would give us an assessment of Xavi and Barcelona after they had gone through that nightmare run that saw them face Rayo away, Porto, Atletico Madrid, and of course, Girona. So it's time now to deliver the grades. Where is this Barcelona side right now, Barlow, and what went wrong against Girona?
So yeah, in terms of the grades for this game, I think I'm going to give them a C+. They got through those kind of that gauntlet. Rayo Vallecano away is a game that we've spoken about. Is something that they don't do well. Porto, Atleti, Girona, it had the potential to decimate their season. So they're still intact. They've lost a point on Real Madrid, but they're not out of the season just yet. They're 5 points off Los Blancos, they're 7 points off Girona. So they're in with a chance still. And going forward, they have looked better. They've created chances. I mean, there's been kind of various spectrums of how well or badly Barcelona played against Girona. I thought that Girona carried out their game plan and looked comfortable in that game throughout, whereas Barcelona were always stretched and always kind of putting in extra effort to try and create these chances. And they did create a lot of chances. They probably should have scored more goals. Robert Lewandowski misses a really gilt-edged chance to level it up in stoppage time before Girona go and score the fourth. So it was perhaps a tighter game than it looks on the score sheet, even if the sense of kind of tactical battle was so far in the favour of Girona, bearing in mind the quality that lies in Barcelona's favour. But coming with that kind of improvement in attack is the fact that they're more open in the back, despite the fact they're playing three central defenders. There's periods of play where they've been good. They've moved the ball quicker. They've looked more dangerous. But it doesn't really feel like there's a direction of travel for Barcelona right now for me. Each game will come down to kind of will João Félix, Rafinha or Lewandowski turn up. The fact that João Félix seems to only do so once every few games is a problem because you can't rely on that. Rafinha, again, I've been losing my mind a little with him of late. I think he's been dreadful recently. Even though he will get goals and assists, he's kind of playing because he runs in behind and he presses well. He's a good defender as a forward, and that's making up for the fact that Lewandowski and João Félix aren't really pressing very well. But that's not a reliable kind of system or a way of moving forward with this team. So Xavi has problems there. Lewandowski is not scoring goals. The confidence of these attackers between Ferran Torres and Lamine Yamal being the other options, who I think have been playing better than both Félix and Rafinha in recent weeks, it's low. And even though they operate better with the ball right now, they're not scoring that many more goals and they're conceding quite a few more. It's still a midfield that lacks control, despite the fact they've got Gundogan, Pedri and De Jong in there. And overall, the Xavi experience, it has been fits and bursts. We've seen really good performances from his side from time to time against Real Madrid at various points, against Atleti, various points. But can he put together a coherent offensive team over the course of kind of 3-4 months? We're yet to see that. And it's a side with limitations. I think Lewandowski is not the player that he was. I think that Rafinha is not the kind of Brazilian winger that they want him to be. He's not Ronaldinho. João Félix is at least not yet that kind of level of player. And so I think sometimes we do judge Xavi a little bit harshly just based on what he has at his disposal. But there are basics. There are basic things for this team, basic defensive kind of mechanisms or even pressing kind of things that don't fit, that don't belong to an elite side. And if you couple that with the fact that Xavi's discourse in the press, which does play a role, never seems to have an answer or an alternative. It's always an excuse or a pretext or an explanation. You can qualify it how you want, but it never seems to really convince fans, analysts, pundits, media, and perhaps more importantly, maybe not the players either. So you've got a side that is kind of trundling along. They've won the league last season. I think that was a brilliant achievement. But as Xavi's tried to advance this side tried to advance this team, we're not really seeing the progress that you expect. And particularly the comparison with Girona's Michel, it was so stark, a team that was so well-drilled, that was so confident, so comfortable, players that knew their roles, players that believed in themselves to make the difference. Whereas Barcelona, it always feels like they're searching for something, and it always feels like there's a little bit of individualism coming into their games. I don't see a coherent plan from the start of the season to kind of where we are right now. And if you look at where Xavi started with this Barcelona side, it's not the same plan as it was then. And you have to adapt to your players, of course, but neither is it a plan that convinces you. And so I think these things can change on kind of a coin flip. They could go on a run in January, and last season we saw them after the World Cup really become a solid outfit. So you never know what's going to happen. Injuries make a big difference too, but it's very hard for me to say that this is a convincing Barcelona side that I think is going to improve under Xavi right now. But it's all up to him to kind of change this and turn it around.
Insightful as always, Barlow. Thank you. Okay, well, on that note, I think we will draw this episode of the podcast to a close. I'll say thank you once again to you, Rory Barlow. I'll say thank you to Michael Jones, and I'll say thank you most of all to you, the listener. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time on the 29th of December, so you can enjoy that episode in that lovely period in between Christmas and New Year when nobody really knows what day it is. In the meantime, stay safe. Stay well and have a Merry Christmas. Goodbye.